Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney. Frank is busy fighting the war of ideas elsewhere today. We have with us this morning Ryan Morrow, who is a national security analyst for the Clarion Project. And Ryan, I wanted to talk with you about a wonderful video that the Clarion Project has regarding this pending nightmare of a deal the president seems to be trying to make with Iran. It's called How to Con America. And I think you guys did a very good job of outlining just exactly what's happening. But tell us how it came to be and give the folks a little idea what the story is.
Sure. Well, the background is that we decided to launch a series of short videos about the nuclear deal with Iran that don't necessarily have new information but are powerful messengers of what the problem is, and is based on a lot of internal research that we did to identify what messages reach different audiences. And so each week leading up to the deal, we've released a video, and you go to clarionproject.org, and you can see each one, and each one has a different style. So if there's a certain friend that you have, you'll be able to choose the one that has the message that will most reach that person, and then send another one to someone else. So it's a very useful tool, and the film that you're referring to, How to Con America, is our most recent one, and it's basically an instructional video on the steps that you need to take in order to con America, in order to get a nuclear weapon. And we compare that to what the Iranian regime is doing. And so the four steps are, first, you need to establish trust, whether it's deserved or not. The second is don't be afraid to lie. The third step is pulling the bait and switch. And then the fourth final one is that you exploit their weakness, the weakness that they've had from the beginning, you know, the failure to recognize the ideology and everything that's going on, and then exploit the weaknesses that we have because of the deal, which would be the fact that we're going to disarm ourselves of the ability to hit them with really tough sanctions.
So it seems to me like you think we are actually not stopping the Iranians from building a bomb with this negotiation process, with this, I guess I would join you and call it almost a charade of diplomacy around the idea that if we make all these public gestures, people won't notice that none of this is actually going to stop, even given the things the president hasn't given away so far. This isn't going to stop the Iranians from building a bomb.
That's right. I remember writing an article some years ago laying out different scenarios for the Iranian regime to get a nuclear bomb. And one of the scenarios is eerily close to this, where I was talking about how Iran could actually come to some type of agreement with the West that enables them to get a nuclear weapon, because there are theoretically some restrictions. And let's suppose that the Iranian regime complies with those restrictions. It's still taking one step back in order to take two steps forward. So if I sat down and I was a mullah and I said, what is the best way to get a nuclear weapon and strengthen the regime and the Islamic revolution as a whole, it would look very similar to this.
Oh, Ryan, you're going to make me cry. I wish you weren't so accurate in this portrayal, because the bottom line, folks, we're talking with Ryan Morrow, who is a national security analyst for the Clarion Project, who have been doing a brilliant job of shining a spotlight on the shady dealings that we are conducting with the mullahs. So they seem to have gamed the system. Now, at this point, is there any deal that is likely to be made that is worth doing, or at this point, are we all better off putting this aside and trying to go back to some sort of increased sanctions, even if they're unilateral, or even down the road, a military strike, anything other than paving a pathway to the bomb for the Iranians?
It would be better to go back to where we were before, because the Iranian economy was in an absolute tailspin. And as you know, the Iranian regime, they always project strength. So when you see any type of panic visibly, then that is just a small percentage of the real panic that they're feeling in hiding. And the economy was so bad, and the Iranian regime was in such trouble because of the very limited sanctions we had before, because you could just see the panic. And then we came in, saved them by signing this interim agreement and getting this process going, and now the Iranian regime is very much stronger than where they were before. And I wrote an op-ed that said, are we saving the Islamic Revolution? Because that ideology was largely bankrupt at that point. It brought nothing but disaster to the people, and now the Iranian regime is going to be able to present the Islamic Revolution and Sharia law as a plausible path towards wealth and national greatness. And that's going to create a whole new generation of terrorists.
Ryan, I wanted to move on to another neighbor of the Iranians, Iraq, and talk about the horrendous persecution, and persecutions, much too polite a word for regicide, regional religicide, I guess. Christians are being killed, slaughtered all over the world. But in Iraq, it's particularly heinous. Tell us a little bit about how the Iraqis feel about the Christians and what they're doing to them in the country.
I found the most discouraging poll of the many polls that I look at on an almost daily basis, which is that, first of all, Iraq is now ranked as the third worst country in the world for Christians. It is only beaten by North Korea and Somalia. So it's really horrible, and listeners of your program know how vicious and bloody it is. But we could always kind of say to ourselves, to try to comfort ourselves, well, you know, the Iraqis don't necessarily want this, that this is the hands of, this is being done at the hands of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the rest, but their Christians at least were loved by their neighbors. And what we found in this poll that was put out is that only 33%, only one-third of Iraqis would even express a concern about Christian persecution. That's not a very high bar. I mean, it's one thing to even, it should be an easy thing to at least get someone to say, yeah, I don't like it and I'm concerned about Christians being massacred. But only one-third cared. 67% are not concerned at all, or are only, quote, somewhat concerned about the misery of the Christians in Iraq. And what's really shocking about this is that more people care in places like Saudi Arabia about the persecution of Christians than Iraqis. And Iraqis know about the persecution the most because it's happening among them.
Yeah. And I guess that, you know, the Saudis being slightly less heinous in their attitudes is one thing. But I think this is somewhat indicative of the rise of extremist Islam, of the rise of, you know, essentially the jihadists all around the world, and the impact they're having, not just, you know, all by cutting off heads and by doing that, but by getting into the mosques, by having the extremists preaching hate worldwide. I think it's changing opinions around the world. And I mean, obviously in Iraq, that's a horrible numbers and lack of concern. But it's really pretty widespread wherever there are large communities of Islamists.
Right, and that's true. But one of the common thoughts was that, okay, this extremism and this persecution is happening, but the general population didn't support it and actually cared but was powerless to stop them or was unwilling to risk their lives for it. And what we found in this poll is that Iraqis largely simply just don't care. They just don't care. And so how do you deal with that? The only solution really is we have to stop discriminating against the Christians. We have to directly arm them. And it frustrates me to hear how we're willing to arm and support the Kurds, arm and support Shias, Shiites, and as well as Sunni tribes. And we're willing to arm virtually every demographic group in Iraq except for the Christians.
Would it be wise, potentially, in the course of what we're doing there, to maybe offer them or try to make a deal with the Kurds to offer them safe haven inside Kurdistan and then let us be kind of their benefactors and let the Peshmerga protect them rather than try to create another armed force?
I don't think so. Most Iraqi Christians say that they're still not treated well by the Kurds, even if they would prefer to be under Kurdish leadership than the other groups in Iraq. But there's a lot of tension between the Christians and the Kurds. And generally the Kurds don't want the Christians to have their own autonomy and their own ability to decide their own fate because there's a difference over the land. There's some conflict there. And frankly, the Kurds have had an armed force for so long, and they have failed to protect the Iraqi Christians to an adequate level. And so I think the only solution is for us to treat the Christians of Iraq as at least equals with other Iraqis. And give them the protection that they deserve.
Brian Morrow of the Clarion Project, thanks for all the good work you guys are doing. Coming up next in segment two, we'll be talking with Philip Carber about what's going on with the Russians, who unfortunately are back in the empire building game. Back with more Secure Freedom Radio after the break.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states. One that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We have the pleasure to be joined this segment by Philip Carber, who just returned from another trip to the front lines in Ukraine, where he witnessed firsthand Russian expansionism. Now, Phil, this is something that has been going on for a while. Vladimir Putin seems to have empire rebuilding on his mind. Tell us a little bit about what's going on, first of all, in Ukraine.
Well, in Ukraine, the ceasefire is not holding, and it's not being enforced by the OSCE, and the Russians are taking advantage of it, and I think at least potentially preparing for another a major assault. So we should expect, I'd say, better than 50-50 chance of that in the next late July, August, early fall.
Now, all right, there's obviously real fighting. How much is this force on force, and how much of this is more on the guerrilla side of things?
There's patrols going on. I would not describe it as guerrilla warfare. There's patrols, both sides are patrolling, and then you'll have periods of extremely intense artillery shelling, and then some direct assault. So this is not low-intensity combat. It is kind of a patrolling, and then periods where you'll have as high intensity combat as anybody's seen in modern conventional war.
Who is fighting? I mean, what kind of flags are flying there? Are the Russians still playing the little green men game?
Yeah, I mean, in general, they sort of have this general pretense, but nobody who's watching takes it that seriously anymore. The Russians are creating two operational corps, core level units in the Donbass. They have over 1,000 tanks, 600 tanks, about 1,500 APCs, close to 1,000 tubes of artillery. To give you an idea, that force is larger than the current West German army, just the force that's in the eastern Ukraine, not counting the stuff that's on the Russian border. And it's being organized. It's commanded by Russian generals. It's organized by and officered by the Russians, supplied by the Russians. But about two-thirds of the manpower are either mercenaries or separatists who were recruited from the Donbass area.
Philip Carber is telling us about what he observed and what he's seen going on in Ukraine. And I think at this point, it feels to me like empire rebuilding. There's been talk of a Novorossiya being, you know, the new Russian empire, and that Russia was always an empire, and a Russia without Ukraine is a country. A Russia with Ukraine is an empire. Do you think that really is driving the Russians on some of their, I guess, expansionism?
I think that seems to be driving part of Putin. I don't claim to have any insight into what really motivates him, but maybe he doesn't. But he's been on record several times as saying that he considered the greatest political tragedy of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. So in a way, he's sort of set his agenda as trying to reconstitute at least some kind of greater Russian zone of interest that includes the lands of a number of other countries, many of them former Soviet, including, I think, probably even some former Warsaw Pact members. And he's been very very articulate. He said, if there's Russians in these areas, I have the right to go in and protect them, even if they're just a minority. He's also said that Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Belarus are not real countries, and also putting heavy pressure on the Baltic republics. So, and not to mention, of course, Georgia and what's going on in the Caucasus. So, there is definitely a mood there that reflects that broader motivation.
Well, now, how much though? If his motivation or if his rationale for some of this is the fact that there are Russians in these places, how many of them were seated there as colonials almost, you know, during the Soviet era? They did some of that in Ukraine. They've done it other places as well.
Sure, sure. You know, whether it's Eastern Latvia or whether it's Crimea. In Crimea, for example, sort of the retirement home of much of the Russian naval and military people. And so they and moving the Tartars, many of the Tartars out, had essentially changed the demographic of that area, and a lot of the areas it's intermixed, and these people have been there for three or four generations. They're heavily influenced by Russian media, which is extremely distorted, so that it and plays to those locals. Now, I think in some areas the evidence is that they're getting wise, whether it's in eastern Latvia or even Belarus, or the many people in the separatist area of Ukraine who I think were initially sort of attracted to being part of a Russian world because they're Russian ethnics, because they speak Russian, they're heavily influenced by Russian information war, are certainly having second thoughts about it because of the reality doesn't match the rhetoric.
Holy cow, the propaganda is like marketing for a failed system. There's a shocker. Well, now let me ask you about our responses, because when President Obama came into power, one of the first things he did was pull us out of some missile defense deployments and basically pushed the reset button with Hillary. And that seems, if nothing else, to have emboldened the Russians more than turned them into partners. Are we, at this point, at least starting to, it seems, move some troops around, conduct some exercises, make some deployments to rattle our own sabers?
Yes, in a pathetically limited way. Let's just talk about Ukraine for a second. You know, the administration said, well, we don't want to be involved in a proxy war. Well, wake up. There is a proxy war. Unfortunately, it's one-sided. They say, well, we don't want to escalate. Well, the Russians can bring in literally thousands of items of major combat equipment. The Ukrainians lose several thousand items of major combat equipment in heavy combat. And what happens with the vaunted sanctions? The most effective sanction the West has imposed is not on Russia, but an embargo on a free people who are just trying to defend themselves. We are essentially sanctioning the victim by not allowing them to even buy Western anti-tank weapons, which they desperately need to try to stop this Russian armor offensive. And that is absolutely criminal. And the interesting thing, people say, well, it's the administration. It really isn't. I mean, you go talk to people who know what's going on in State Department, Pentagon, Congress, intelligence community. They all agree. There's basically three people left who are preventing the U.S. from allowing Ukraine to defend itself, and that's the president, his national security advisor, Rice, and his chief of staff, Jared. It's three people.
Well, fortunately, at a minimum, they'll be gone in January of 2017, but that's a long time from now, and Ukraine may not survive in its current form that long. Is there any impression from you or others that the Russians are going to push this and try to actually topple Ukraine, or are they just going to nibble away at it?
Well, what's the pattern they've had is they'll launch the Russians launch an offensive in August, and then had a major battle at Ilyovaisk, which defeated a number of Ukrainian brigades, and then there was a ceasefire, which they didn't observe. Then it was a bleeding ceasefire through the fall. Then they launched another attack in January, the winter offensive, which cost Ukraine very heavy casualties and, again, a major defeat because they don't have these anti-tank weapons that they need. The Russians have reactive armor on their tanks, which stops any anti-tank weapon that doesn't have a dual or what's called a tandem warhead. There's only two in the West, Javelin and TOW-2. The Ukrainians have begged to buy them, if not from us, from other allies, and up till now we refuse to provide it. So basically, their infantry is trying to hold on against tanks. They have used their artillery fairly effectively, but under the Minsk II ceasefire that was negotiated or forced on them by Hollande and Merkel, the ceasefire pulls their artillery back 50 kilometers out of range. So if the Russians now attack, they hit that frontline infantry, and they have nothing but their hands and hand grenades and small rocket launchers to try to defend themselves. It is absolutely criminal.
Unfortunately, I don't hold out a lot of hope that our current administration is going to help them, but let's talk about it, let's publicize it, let's put some pressure on them to do the right thing. Thank you, Philip, for being with us here. Coming up next, we'll be talking with Roger Noriega about what's going on in our own hemisphere. South America has plenty of its own problems.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The United States Senate this week indulged in an act of moral preening and unilateral disarmament. Moral preening because senators bought into the argument that our enemies or others will think better of us if future jihadists we want to interrogate know exactly the techniques to which they will be subjected. And unilateral disarmament because the Senate has foreclosed our use of any techniques we haven't publicly endorsed. Our adversaries, of course, are operating under no such restrictions. Should the Senate's prohibitions actually become law, it is predictable that we will get even less of the human intelligence we need from individuals who have inside knowledge of secretive terrorist organizations. Sorry, Senator, we can't afford to make it any easier than it already is to wage war against us with impunity. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
On June 22nd, the Center for Security Policy will honor Representative Trent Franks of Arizona's 8th Congressional District and the mayor of Irving, Texas, Beth Van Dyne, at its annual Freedom Flame Award Dinner. The evening will take place at the exclusive Metropolitan Club of New York City. For tickets and more information, visit www.securefreedom.org.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word: answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. At the G7 summit in Germany this week, President Obama said this about his strategy to take on ISIS in Iraq.
When a finalized plan is presented to me by the Pentagon, then I will share it with the American people. It's not, we don't yet have a complete strategy.
How can President Obama in June 2015 still not have a plan to deal with ISIS in Iraq? After all, he also said this in August 2014. The truth is the president does have a strategy to deal with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. It's to put significant restrictions on U.S. troops and to do as little as possible so he can say he's a president who got the United States out of wars, not into one. Ultimately, the president wants to hand this mess to the next president. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, and we have the pleasure this segment of talking with Roger Noriega, who was former Assistant Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere under President George W. Bush, and is founder of the Inter-American Security Watch. Roger, there's a lot going on in our own neck of the woods. As much as we like to focus on the rest of the world, I think we fail to take a good look at the dangers right here. Now, there's some apparent talks of some sort underway between a senior State Department official and a narco trafficker in Venezuela. Can you give us a little insight as to what that might be about?
Right. On Saturday, Thomas Shannon, who's the counselor to the Secretary of State, Kerry, met with a man, Diosdado Cabello, who published reports say is the capo of a cocaine cartel that operating out of Venezuela. He's the president of the National Assembly, very important senior political leader. And inexplicably, he turned up in Haiti in a meeting with this senior U.S. diplomat. It seems like fairly brazen interference with an ongoing criminal investigation and a rather risky, if not frankly foolhardy move on the part of this U.S. diplomat. This administration will stop at nothing to find an accommodation with that anti-American criminal regime. And I hope Congress follows up vigorously to find out what's going on, because it looks like a debacle in the making.
I mean, they can't not know this is a bad guy. So they're obviously just willing to overlook that and as you mentioned, do what's necessary to further their support for this regime. Let me ask you another thing that is going on is that the Venezuelans are apparently selling their U.S. refinery due to the fact that their economy is dying, I guess, is close to the truth. How is that playing out?
Well, to understand what's happening in Venezuela today, you have to be a fan of Scorsese movies, because essentially this is a mafia kind of busting out a pizza joint, except it happens to be a country. It's a bankrupt country, no rule of law, so investment has sunken, food line scarcity, power outages, just a collapsing country. And they're selling off PDVSA assets piece by piece to make money to pay bills or pay bonds that are owned by other corrupt officials in the government. So it is really just part of the whole death throes of that regime. And quite frankly, I don't know why we want to prop it up with these kinds of cynical encounters with criminals. Quite frankly, we should be sanctioning these people, sending a message that the United States is going to hold people accountable for looting that country, for shoveling cocaine, not only into the United States, but through Central America and Mexico, sowing mayhem everywhere it goes. This is a regime that you can't appease. They've already done enough damage to this administration by coddling them for years. We've got to get very strong, stand with the real Democrats in that country, and insist on some accountability for the corruption and criminality. And we need be a strong voice for that, and challenging other countries in Latin America to step up to the plate to confront that threat. And it's going to take a lot of work of the U.S. exposing this criminality, drawing red lines, and I mean real ones, not fake ones. And quite frankly, that worries me, because this administration seems incapable of doing that. I think President Obama, quite frankly, is looking to preserve his photo op in Havana, and if that means turning a blind eye or even for that matter, coddling the mess the Cubans have sown in Venezuela, he'll do it. It's just really shockingly cynical.
Well, okay, we're not doing much. We are being, I think it's fair to say, cynical and irresponsible. But the Chinese do not appear to be, or maybe they're being cynical and self-interested. But they are propping this regime up. They are providing liquidity and assets to them, it seems, in return for some of that liquid gold. Should that be worrying us that we're ceding that vital resource in our own hemisphere to the Chinese?
Absolutely. I mean, our imports of Venezuelan crude are cut in half in the last 10 years. That's why they're one of the reasons why they can sell that refinery. In the meantime, China's imports have gone up in the last 10 years from Venezuela from 40,000 barrels a day to somewhere north of 600,000 barrels a day. I warned about this shift years ago when the so-called experts said that this wasn't realistic, but it's happening. The Chinese, on the other hand, are, you know, they put about $40 billion in that economy, and quite frankly are wondering what they're going to get out of it because that regime collapsing. So they're having their own misgivings, but the bottom line is, they're trying to engage in a fire sale all over Latin America, buying up assets depleted by corruption. And they're playing the long haul game, and we're going to need to push back in a serious way before they start posing a security threat from that part of the world, not just an economic competition.
And the Chinese have been doing a lot of that worldwide. They've been buying up mineral rights and oil in Africa and all over Asia and any place they can get to those scarce resources that, you know, are necessary to run the modern world. Is it possible for them, even in the broken state of the Venezuelan regime, to make a legitimate investment? Are they, you know, devious enough to be potentially looking to prop up a regime that will continue to sell them what they want?
Well, I think they'd sell out the Nicolas Maduro's regime if they got reasonable assurances from the opposition that they would more or less honor some of their commitments by continuing to provide oil for the money that they've already given the Venezuelans. So, you know, they're a pretty cynical bunch, obviously. But we, you know, frankly, I don't think they would be as bold in the region if we had, made it very clear that We wouldn't tolerate the kind of corrupt practices that the Chinese usually employ. Even in a sophisticated country like Brazil is learning a very tough lesson doing business with them. They pinned too much of their hopes on this commodity boom, and when it dropped out, when the bottom dropped out there, their economy is now into a recession, and the economy will shrink 1.5% this year. And along with the corruption and Chinese swooping in and buying up bargains in Brazil, caused by China closing its market to some Brazilian companies. So it's pretty ruthless stuff. They're not a very charming lot. So I think that the chances of U.S. Business getting in there, if the competition is fair, is pretty good, because I think they would much rather do business with people that can be trusted, at least within reason.
Well, let's hope it turns out that way. Let's move a little closer to home, at least here in America, and talk about Mexico's military acquisitions from us. They seem to be getting an awful lot of serious military hardware. Are they going to make a major push against the drug gangs?
Well, you know, this worries me a little bit. Now, it's going to sound ironic, because I'm pretty adamant that you have to have a strong security component in dealing with these narcos. It can't just be done with midnight basketball and tattoo removal kits. And that's, you know, the kind of soft side that, you know, culture of lawfulness and all that's nonsense. That's wonderful stuff, but it's not going to do very much when you have narcos throwing hand grenades at you. And that's literally what happens. But at the same time, when I see the substantial increases, in military purchases in Mexico, frankly, I just see corruption. I see people probably shaving substantial sums off of these purchases, and military purchases is the hardest or easiest to hide money in, because of the black budgets and because you have the so-called independence of the military. And you can't shoot your way out of this mess. Frankly, they have to do a better job with a comprehensive security strategy to deny the ability of these narcos to operate, to launder money, to engage in all of the different criminal activities they're engaged in. And yes, you have to confront the increasingly bold and violent narcos. But, tanks and helicopters isn't what's called for when you're talking about urban the urban criminal challenge that they're facing.
Well, Roger, hopefully we can at least shine a light on those kind of shady activities. We've been talking with Roger Noriega, former Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere and founder of the Inter-American Security Watch. Up next, we'll talk with Bill Gertz, senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, about some of the interesting intel that is happening in and around the D.C. and our friends area.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anniesoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom, it's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're talking this segment with Bill Gertz, senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. And Bill, I wanted to ask you a question about a recent defection of a Tajik Special Forces commander who we did a fair amount of training, both U.S. training, and apparently he went to Blackwater, who has now defected to ISIS and may have significantly added to their real military capabilities. Tell us a little bit about this.
It's an important story that I broke this week showing that the defection of a Colonel Gulmurad Kalimov, he was the commander of an Interior Ministry security unit called OMON, trained by the U.S., in special operations capabilities. He disappeared in April and then just recently, late last month, appeared in an Islamic State video declaring his allegiance to the Islamic State and threatening jihad throughout Central Asia. A State Department security report that I got a hold of said that this kind of a thing, this defection, could be, quote, a game changer for the Islamic State efforts to spread its brand of radical Islamic jihad in the region. Another data point in this problem was that several months ago, there was a plot by the Islamic State in Southeast Asia, in Malaysia, to conduct terrorist operations. And as a result of that, authorities in Malaysia uncovered the fact that at least two Malaysian military officers were involved in the plot. And that led to uncovering of a large number of sympathizers. So here you have two militaries in Islamic countries that are being infiltrated by the Islamic State. It shows that this is a real problem.
Now, I've actually trained the Malaysian military back when I was in first group. And overall, I would say the Malaysians are some of the least extreme Muslims. And it's a little scary if at this point things have digressed to the point where their leaders in the military are now potentially joining the other side. Is there any indication that this Tajik colonel is going to stay in the area or potentially be, you know, I mean, they're a pretty dispersed group. ISIS at this point will take allegiance from anyone. Is there any indications of how he might be involved in their operations?
Well, at this point, they don't expect the defection to translate into immediate increased capabilities, but they do see it as kind of a long-range problem. The Tajik government just came out and put out an international arrest warrant accusing Kalimov of treason. But there is concern that if economic problems persist in that part of the region, that the Islamic State could gain a greater foothold. And they pointed out that there's you know, the average wage in Tajikistan is about $170 a month. And by contrast, the Islamic State is paying its fighters up to $400 a month. So even if they're marginally radicalized Muslims, there's a real concern with somebody in a high-profile military position like that. He could bring other types of other military people in or other commando-type people, which would give them a greater special forces-type capability.
Which is absolutely what we don't need them to have. And now part of the reason we were in Tajikistan and training him is we needed basing there and we needed supply routes into Afghanistan. So do you think this is in any part related to the fact that now we're, I guess Obama ended the war in Afghanistan and now we're less concerned with them. So a lot of those places may be more vulnerable to recruitment.
Yeah, I think the big factor there is that the Tajik government right now has aligned itself with Russia. So Russia is kind of the big target for the Islamist terrorists in that part of the world. So in his statement, he issued a lot of inflammatory threats against the Tajikistan leadership, said they're coming to kill all the leaders, and we're going to focus on both Russia and the United States as part of their operations.
Well, and the Islamists do nothing but follow the strong horse. And right now, it'd be a hard thing to make the case that the United States is the strong horse anywhere. Let's talk about other potential strong horses, one being China. Now, they have been pretty militant and aggressive in pursuing maritime claims and air superiority claims over large swaths of the Pacific Rim. And now it seems that our U.S. Pacific Command said that if they keep that up, we may exclude them from, you know, participation in naval exercises that we've recently been conducting that they were a part of. What's going on with that?
Yeah, this was the comments made by the brand new U.S. Pacific Command commander, Admiral Harry Harris, formerly the Pacific Fleet commander, got the promotion and took over the command just last month. And he basically came out during a meeting with reporters in Tokyo and said, was asked about if China continues the buildup of these islands and the military buildup on these newly created 2,000 acres of South China Sea islands in the Spratlys mainly, which is claimed by the Philippines and a number of other states, that he would then, in fact, go ahead and disinvite the People's Liberation Army Navy from taking part in the big international naval exercise called Rim of the Pacific, or RIMPAC. The last one was in 2014. I think they had like 30 different nations participating. The Chinese sent two naval vessels to participate, and then at the same time sent a AGI, or intelligence gathering ship, to spy on the exercises. Again, kind of undermining the whole rationale for bringing the Chinese into the exercise. Well, Harris is now saying that unless the Chinese halt this construction, that he will consider canceling their participation in next year's RIMPAC.
I wanted to ask you again, there's another thing you've been working on to get the Obama administration's document detailing their support for the Muslim Brotherhood declassified. Now, that's a shocker. The Muslim Brotherhood is bad guys. They're jihadists. They're the civilization jihadists, but they're not somebody we should be in favor of working with. And yet you've uncovered what looks like some pretty heinous ties between the Obama administration and this terrorist group.
Yes, this is the key document. It's being kept secret by the White House. It's called Presidential Study Directive 11, or PSD 11. Efforts to try and get it declassified both by members of Congress and Judicial Watch and activist groups have been unsuccessful so far. But according to people who've seen the document, it lays out in fairly concrete terms how the Obama administration is supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. This is the Islamist group, which is extremist in the political sense, but is not yet in the violent phase, what Frank Gaffney has termed the pre-violent phase. And they are the ideological brothers of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. There's very little difference. And yet the Obama administration has totally misunderstood the nature of the threat posed by the Muslim Brotherhood and has been promoting this group in the Middle East. And we don't know to what extent they've done the same in the United States, but we do know that Muslim Brotherhood officials are closely aligned with many of the key advisors in the Obama administration.
Now, it looks like the Obama team has supported these guys in their efforts to come to power in Egypt and other places overseas. Is this something you think they're still doing, or do you think that, you know, shining a light on this may have caused them to reconsider?
No, I think that they're still doing that, and I think that this is going to continue to be a problem until we get another administration. Hillary Clinton is just as guilty as supporting the Muslim Brotherhood as when she was Secretary of State as the president and his closest advisors are in their concern for it. Now, the hope is that if we get a new administration in there, we'll recognize this threat and take steps to really turn that around. We should not be supporting the Muslim Brotherhood in any way, shape, or form. We should be opposing it, especially from an ideological standpoint, which we really need to do. That's the ultimate way to win the war on terrorism, is to attack the terrorist ideology and defeat it.
Well, they declared a civilization jihad in the Muslim Brotherhood's own words against us, and it's time for us to return the favor. Folks, we've been talking with Bill Gertz with some excellent information. Keep digging, Bill. We need that. All right, this is going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank will be back on Monday to keep fighting the war of ideas.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.